Translation: if on earth one performs sacrifices for the satisfaction of the demigods, he goes to the heavenly planets, where just like a demigod, he enjoys all the heavenly pleasures he has earned by his performances. Next text. Having achieved the heavenly planets, the performer of ritualistic sacrifices travels in a glowing airplane, which he obtains as a result of his piety on earth. Being glorified by songs sung by the Gandharvas and dressed in wonderfully charming clothes, he enjoys life surrounded by heavenly goddesses. Accompanied by heavenly women, the enjoyer of the fruits of sacrifice goes on pleasure rides in a wonderful airplane, which is decorated with circles of tinkling bells, and which flies wherever he desires, being relaxed, comfortable, and happy in the heavenly pleasure gardens. He does not consider that he is exhausting the fruits of his piety and will soon fall down to the mortal world. Until his pious results are used up, the performer of sacrifice enjoys life in the heavenly planets. When the pious results are exhausted, however, he falls down from the pleasure gardens of heaven, being moved against his desire by the force of eternal time. Om Agyana Tirmanandasya Janashalakya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guru Vainava Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhuddha Jananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasavi Go Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Kala Chalitaha, pushed down by time. We were speaking briefly about this point last night, in an introductory way, of course. The time is not just tick, tick, tick on your watch. Time is bringing things. It's bringing you your karmic reactions. Here we find that by the force of eternal time, you fall down from the heavenly planets, because your bank account of pious activities is exhausted. People are fascinated by the rise and fall of material civilizations, materialistic societies all over the world now. They're discussing, is this the decline of the USA? Others say, no, no. The great American innovative spirit cannot fail. It'll bounce back. One thing we should understand, I was speaking about a program in Arcadia a few nights ago. We have to understand the neighborhood we live in. We live in the middle planetary system. That means mixed happiness and distress. In order to properly plan our activities and how we're going to achieve our goals, we need to understand the terrain that we're living, in which we're living. It's like if you're living in a dangerous part of the city, you're prepared for crime, violence, so on and so forth. If you're living in a wealthy part of the city, then you have different expectations. What should we expect living in the middle planetary system? Just like people on the Earth planet in today's materialistic societies, they keep an eye on property values, interest rates, how to mortgage, how to remortgage, how to buy, how to sell off, market timing, so on and so forth. Simply, we need to be aware of our situation in the cosmos, and that is what the Bhagavatam will unfailingly help you to do, to see how you fit into the cosmos. There's so much talk about cosmic dislocation. People don't feel a part of nature. That's as far as they get, generally. We don't feel a part of nature anymore on the Earth planet. We're alienated from nature. And the Bhagavatam is dealing with the whole material cosmos at least and far beyond. So how do we belong to the cosmos? First, we have to understand that by our situation in the middle planetary system, things are never going to be completely good. Things are never going to be completely bad. There'll always be the mixture. Even when in materialistic societies, it seems like there's a good run, a good stretch, there'll also be bad runs in which things are miserable. But that won't last for long in the middle planetary system. Then there'll come a stretch where things seem good, let the good times roll, just up and down all the time. Yes, it's enough to drive you crazy. We must look at the nature of the economic development that people are so attached to. Because the economic development is happening without yajna, therefore it is so troublesome. It's like a roller coaster ride, but no one can understand that point. They think economic development is all up to our prowess. And now it turns out it's all up to our conniving and cheating abilities. If you want to make a huge fortune, it's very simple. You become an investment banker and you package all sorts of shady loans and you get your incentives, your bonuses, and you don't even care that your own firm that you're working for goes down. You've got your bonuses. It's hard for the average person to understand this. If you're working for such and such a firm, you naturally you want to see that firm profitable. But it doesn't work like that anymore. Get your cut first and let your own firm crash. Who cares? The ordinary man's bewildered by all this. They live in a financial system they can't understand. It's so complex. So all this subterfuge and roller coaster ride comes because the economic development is unhinged from yajna. To hinge your economic development on ritualistic sacrifice to attain better material enjoyment or devotional yajna to please the Supreme Personality, got it. People look at that as primitive. They feel that their material prosperity all depends upon them. Now, what to do? Their economic system is so complex they can't understand it. Who to blame? No one wants to point the finger at themselves, at the people in general, being the bearing the load, bearing the blame. Each person has a desire for economic expansion. That actually is lust. Srila Prabhupada made what I consider to be a very insightful statement, as always. He said that economic development is lust on an organized scale. Everyone knows what individual lust is like. But this economic complexity that people are so bewildered by or fascinated by alternatively, it is lust on an organized social scale, a huge glob of lust. That is the economy. So unless you solve the individual lust problem, how are you going to solve the problems with economic affairs? People are so they're so caught up in economic concerns that it's like the economy is a person. Just like you're talking about a person's health now. The economy is ailing. Yeah. Or the economy is booming. The economy is reviving. It becomes a person. Now, if you talk about the demigods in that way, people think that behind nature there are conscious personalities directing the affairs of nature. They think you're a bit loony. But talk about the economy as a personal entity, and that's normal. Let's coax the economy back to life. Let's massage the economy. Let's stimulate the economy. Let's see. A prime example for the dissatisfaction of material society is Hiranyakashipu. He at least understood that in order to enjoy, you need to perform austerity. So he did austerities like had never been seen before. He got his benedictions from Brahma, as you know. But he didn't understand any benediction can be overturned when you offend the lotus feet of a devotee. He didn't take that into his equation. So let's look at the power of Hiranyakashipu in terms of his effect on the heavenly planets. He had all the principal demigods serving him, except for Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. Everyone else was subordinate to him. This is how powerful he was by austerity. He took over the functions of the demigods. This is Vayu, Agni, Indra. He took over all those functions and controlled the heavenly planets. The functions of nature were going on because of Hiranyakashipu. The earth was yielding all its bounty. Nature was giving its products, all because of Hiranyakashipu. This is how powerful he was. Nothing could rival his material power. And what to speak of his sense gratification? It just expanded exponentially. And the Bhagavatam points out, he was always intoxicated. He achieved the pinnacle of what we now consider civilization. To be constantly intoxicated and constantly have sense gratification. It doesn't get any better than that. He had it. Plus power. And what was his state of mind? Dissatisfaction. In spite of having inconceivable power, even though it's material still, it's inconceivable the extent of his power, inconceivable amounts of sense gratification, still he was dissatisfied. Because he was the servant of his senses. This is a very, very deep point. He had it all, but he was dissatisfied. Because instead of being the master of his senses, he was a servant. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada makes a very telling point in the purport that Hiranyakashipu is a prime example of the dissatisfaction that you experience in a materialistic society. Just like Prahlad is the prime example of the bhakta. We need exemplars for everything. And so in Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, you find these opposite poles. One is an example of the dissatisfaction that must afflict a material society, no matter how much economic power is there, no matter how much sense gratification is there. The other is a prime exemplar of pure devotion to Krishna in all circumstances. Hiranyakashipu's reign was so full of terrorism that the brahmanas cursed him. All the brahmanas just cursed him repeatedly. And through the demigods, all the living entities prayed for his downfall. As you know, in spite of his powerful run, his powerful stint at the helm of universal affairs, everything crumbled when he began to torment his own son, Prahlad. So, Yudhisthira Maharaj very expertly asked the question to Narada Muni. Usually, there's an affectionate father and there is a reverential son. And we actually find that is so in the case of Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu was actually affectionate towards his son. You remember the scene where he picks up Prahlad and puts him on his lap and smells his head and asks, what's the best thing you've learned in school? This is affection. And Prahlad certainly had reverence toward his father and was the ideal son. The Shastra describes Hiranyakashipu had four sons, all wonderful and qualified. Obviously, three of the four were very materially wonderful in terms of power and strength and material expertise. And Prahlad, however, was the best amongst those four wonderful sons because he's Krishna's devotee. Yudhishthira Maharaj asks, okay, we have an affectionate father and we have a reverential son. Yet, why did the father seek to rub out his son, to torment his son? This is a contradiction. Generally, a parent, if he chastises his son, it's out of affection to correct the son. So Yudhishthira is asking Adamuni, what's going on between Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu? We have affection, we have reverence, yet we have extreme cruelty, which has nothing to do with helping the son. How is this going on? It's very important how Yudhishthira Maharaj is asking Narada Muni, please clarify the situation of a devotee. In other words, in order to understand a devotee, we need to hear from a devotee. This is the, these are the dynamics in the bhakti world. You have to get inside the house to understand the affairs of the house. Otherwise, from outside the house, you cannot understand. The example we usually give, you have to go inside the bottle of honey. You can't lick the bottle from the outside. So Yudhishthira Maharaj is demonstrating that the bhakti science is state-specific. According to your state of consciousness, your level of consciousness, that determines how much transcendental scientific knowledge you can understand. In fact, all knowledge is state-specific. According to your level of consciousness, that is what you see, that's what you perceive, that's what you understand. This concept is generally quite alien to mainstream scholarship, science, education. The Western system has very brilliantly and very deftly separated your behavior, your consciousness. Of course, most of them don't even know what consciousness is. Many don't even admit it exists. There's a complete cleavage between how you act and what you can understand. In other words, you cannot take anyone's personal behavior as an indication of their fund of knowledge. There's no connection whatsoever. Here at this mandir, you're having a nice brahmachari program amidst the other ashrams. And the cornerstone of brahmachari life is the understanding that my personal behavior will influence what I can perceive. Therefore, I want to learn how to render humble devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then, regardless of whatever my ashram station is in the future, I'll have that solid understanding that selfless service provides the vision to understand Krishna, the devotees. This is, according to the Western approach to knowledge, this is very alien. What does it matter how humble you are? What does it matter how clean you are? And what to speak of austerities? Just like economic affairs, economic development depends on your prowess, your cheating abilities, your conniving abilities. Similarly, your academic achievements simply depend on your material brilliance. And actually, but behind the scenes, they'll admit that's not so. One devotee, he was going for his PhD in artificial intelligence. And he had an academic advisor who was just tormenting him, just making life so difficult, practically putting him into tears. And so as a PhD candidate, he had to go to academic conferences around the world. So he was going to a conference in Canada for artificial intelligence, and one of the big guns in the field took sympathy upon him. So this innocent lad doesn't understand how the game is played. So she took him aside and said, "You know, let me explain to you how it works in the PhD world. It's not so much about your knowledge. It's all about whom you drink with." You got to learn to drink with the right people, and your PhD will be a breeze. This is the big gun in the field. So he just didn't know what to, the poor devotee didn't know what to say. he was busy accumulating a whole library of books about how to argue your point, how to make presentations, just trying to come up with some expertise in terms of dealing with his academic advisors. You know, he had to defend his PhD and make a proper presentation. They'd always rip him to pieces. So he's collecting a whole library of, you know, how to argue, how to negotiate, how this and that. And then to hear, it all depends on whom you drink with. So to connect our behavior with our powers of cognition and comprehension, this is considered quite radical today. Hiranyakashipu is an example of someone who wanted to totally disrupt the system of piety leading to power. Although he got his power from austerity, his goal was, I'll do what I like now. No one can stop me. This can happen even in the heavenly planets. There are disturbances. There is no pure happiness available in material existence. It's just the heavenly planets are a high-class neighborhood where generally things go on very heavenly, but there are also disturbances. Just like during the time of Bali Maharaj. He conquered the heavenly planets. He took over the throne of Indra, and he started filling all the top demigod posts with demons. In other words, he was overturning the laws of nature. So this happens from time to time in the heavenly planets. Now, in the middle planetary system, we should expect there's going to be boom and bust, happiness, distress, good periods, bad periods. That's just the way it's going to be. Because no one in this stage of the age of Kali has understanding of yajna and how yajna relates to economic expansion. And their knowledge is not based on developing proper behavior, achar, proper qualities. So you have all this madness going on in the name of economic affairs and academics. And people are starting to wonder, does it do the world any good? I'll give you an example from a university in New Zealand. One professor told me, he was very disturbed. We had a meeting, a university-wide meeting of all the professors, department heads, and the president of the university. And the subject came up that there was a new course developed some kind of exotic psychological counseling. And that course had no bearing on practical reality. And if a student studied it when he graduated, he'd not be able to get a job. He's just basic. He might as well have taken underwater basket weaving or something. So, why are we offering this course to students? We're just wasting their time. It's just some kind of flower in the sky or horse egg. So, the president of the university took the podium and gave him a stern lecture. You don't understand. You're quite old-fashioned. The university institution is a business. We provide courses that attract buyers. That's our concern. They buy a course, and then what happens? That's up to them. Our job is to keep the business afloat. And that means we need to come up with newer and newer and more attractive courses, regardless of their practical outcome. And then the university president said, look, do you all understand this? Are there any dissenters? There were a few dissenters, but they dared not speak up for fear of losing their job. Whereas the professor who spoke up, he was senior, so he left the university and opened up his own consultancy. But the junior protesters, they had to shut up because they didn't want to risk their livelihood. So then a few months later, they had another university meeting, and the president turned to all the professors and said, look, the pressure is on us. We're in a highly competitive market. Each professor has to come up with a new course. If you want, that's the way to guarantee you can keep your job. Come up with a new course that will attract more students. And you can be assured that your employment is guaranteed. So this is the state of affairs these days. Who is really interested in knowledge and understanding? Everyone's interested in whatever leads to money and lust. This is the Hiranyakashipu principle. And just like it caused havoc eventually, similarly, you can't expect in the middle planetary system that there'll ever be lasting prosperity, there'll ever be lasting peace. If you want to understand the principle of human development, global development these days, it's basically quite easy. It's world peace and prosperity through sense gratification. Take away the religion. Take away any kind of behavioral standards. Let your senses go out of control and there'll be world peace. Yeah. That's about it in a nutshell. And this is the Hiranyakashipu principle. He had inconceivable power. He had sense gratification like we could never imagine, yet he was completely dissatisfied. Basically, we have to lower our expectations. Just like if you're living in a bad part of the city, you lower your expectations. You don't have so many dreams that life will be rosy. The Bhagavatam helps us to keep our expectations in the proper perspective, in the proper context. Where our intelligence is being honed by hearing these Bhagavatam verses. The heavenly planets, you can only stay there until the force of time drags you down. Your pious activities have run out. Yet there's some foolishness in us that always yearns for better material happiness, better material comforts. We want things to be all right. We want things to be nice. That hope for fruit of activity which leads to pleasure is a deep contamination embedded in us. So this chapter of the Bhagavatam gets at that root of fruit of activity. stated elsewhere in this chapter, it is said that anyone who thinks that fruit of activity is beneficial will always find the results are insubstantial. How to replace fruit of activity with something else? That's the big question. And that's what people are starting to want to understand, because everything is blowing up in their face. What are you going to do if you don't do action for fruit of results? What are you going to do? What's worth striving for? How are you going to be satisfied? Like one young lady was saying to me last night, I have a job, but I don't feel fulfilled by my job. So I had to explain to her, jobs aren't meant to fulfill you. Maybe I should change jobs and find a more fulfilling job. I tried to explain to her that by working without attachment for the results, by working in order to support a spiritual lifestyle, a Krishna conscious lifestyle, then your work life will start to make sense to you. But simply going to work to get, you'll never be satisfied. You'll never be fulfilled. The dream of work fulfillment, of course, is a very scary dream, and it's full of its ups and downs. I remember in my family, my middle brother, during the 70s, he was a radical activist. And then our youngest brother, he's quite a bit younger than us, 8 or 10 years. So and my youngest brother was in the university. During the summer, in law school, he got a job with NBC News. And he was, you know, some kind of newscaster assistant or something, a summer job. And so my middle brother got on his case, you know, in true 70s, you know, radical spirit. What are you doing working for the system like that? You know, how can you just be a part of this brainwashing mechanism that's mesmerizing the whole country? You know, it was giving it to him. And my youngest brother just looked at him and said, you're just a relic left over from the 60s. I find this job fulfilling. That's all that matters. So people have this hope for a fulfilling job, but again, you have to understand that it is fruit of activity that spoils everything. And this is a scary concept for many people to understand. I mean, what's wrong with acting for your happiness? What's wrong with acting to get ahead? What's wrong with acting to help those who are near and dear to you? Give a little charity. What's wrong with all that? It's a scary concept for them. And when there is economic tough times, and when there are hardships or bewildering times, people start to think, and that becomes a very good time for teaching Krishna consciousness. People start to wonder what's going on. When times are good, it's just the nature of human affairs. It's very difficult for persons to question fruit of activity. Now is a good time, though. People are wanting to understand, is there something else? It's a great time for bringing knowledge of bhakti and demonstrating the Krishna conscious lifestyle. Otherwise, without seeing examples, it's impossible to understand that there can be a replacement for fruit of activity. The example of Prahlad Maharaj shows how trivial it is to aspire for the heavenly planets. Lord Nrisimhadev, even, you might say, tried to entrap Prahlad. Don't you want liberation? Don't you want liberation? Don't you want liberation? Ask for any benediction. Ask for any benediction. And again, Prahlad said, I just want pure devotional service to your lotus feet. I don't mind if I have to take birth thousands of times. Just give me that pure bhakti. By the example of Prahlad Maharaj, not only is the pleasure of the heavenly planets seen to be useless, but even liberation itself is minimized, all by his devotion. Our bhakti depends on examples and personal guidance. Otherwise, it's impossible to see your way through the labyrinth of karmic activity and acting for fruitive results. Because we see examples, and we're trying to become examples, therefore we can understand these texts which show that even the most heavenly pleasure is useless. What to speak of earthly delights, earthly gains and successes. All right, we'll stop here. And any comments from our esteemed senior vice
chancellor? Hare Bol Maharaj. Thank you for the next class. You mentioned how in material life, sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. It's the middle planet. It's not going to be all one or the other. How does that work in spiritual life? Because we also find that you can be very enthusiastic and you feel like everything is all fine, and fine, and sometimes nothing's coming, there's no taste, and maybe I made a mistake, you know. How does that work in this life?
Actually, as you well know, our bhakti is not so much about what we're tasting, it's about how is Krishna relishing our service. In the beginning, until you start focusing on that target, you do experience these ups and downs because you haven't completely locked into the system yet. Your radar is not completely focused, so to speak. So you kind of feel these ups and downs because you're taking up the bhakti process generally is out of a hope for I'm going to feel good, I'm going to be happy, I'm going to be blissful. Do I feel blissful this morning? I don't feel so blissful this morning. You have the bliss meter out every morning, especially the younger devotees, you know? Is it so? Do I really feel like what they say I should feel? Am I blissful? I don't know. Well, is he blissful? No, I'm not blissful today. I remember as a young devotee going out on Sankirtan, the Brooklyn Temple, I guess Jarita Prabhu was there, and there was one young devotee who was having difficulty. He was an uninitiated devotee, and he was about to, he was considering his other options. And so he, at that time, Ramapada Maharaj, he was a brahmacharya, he was a Sankirtan leader. So this young bhakta gave me like the striking evidence why the process was lacking. He said, even Ramapada is not blissful every day.
that was he read it.
So it's like that in the beginning phases of bhakti, and even you can be around for many years in Krishna consciousness, but if you fail to understand the standard of pure devotion, the seas will be choppy because you're always looking for your own happiness. It's so wonderful that you're looking for your own happiness in Krishna consciousness, and we don't want to demean that. We don't want to, you know, have some kind of secret police saying, are you trying to be blissful? Are you thinking of your own happiness in Krishna consciousness? It's not like that. Still, the fact is, until we start focusing, until we start honing in on how to give Krishna pleasure, we're going to feel those choppy seas. Prahlad Maharaj, for example, he was always feeling the embrace of the Supreme Lord, so much so that he's like a child, the Bhagavatam says, who doesn't understand how his bodily necessities are going on, eating, sleeping, evacuating, so on and so forth. He's simply relishing the affection on the lap of his mother. You can remember when you've seen little babies, they don't know how their eating is going on or who's changing their nappies or this or that and the other. It just, you know, they're just oblivious to it all. So that's the way Prahlad's pure devotion was, that he's just absorbed in Krishna's service. So these examples, such as examples of Prahlad Maharaj and others, are meant to inspire us that we can start thinking of Krishna's pleasure and we'll be all right. We've got that Western spirit of acquisition and achievement in us. That, you know, you've got to think for yourself. Even in spiritual life, you've got to think. When I say think for yourself, I mean you've got to think about your own pleasure, your own bliss. Gradually, though, as you mature in bhakti, it becomes actually comprehensible and conceivable that you can just go on thinking, how can Krishna get all the pleasure? And you'll be all right. Then you become peaceful. And the choppy seas die down. Thank you for that point. Anything else? All right. I thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna.